Good afternoon. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. Welcome, and let the record show that the House Resources Committee was convened at 1:04 p.m. Present are Representative Josephson, Representative Olson, Representative Seaton, Representative Mike Harker, Vice Chair, my fellow co-chair, Representative David Tallarico, myself, Ben Dimonog, Ben and I don't know who, they did a typo. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello to Julie from House Records, and hello to Matt from LIO. I understand we have an unbirthday today. And somebody forgot to tell us yesterday. Hello.
I did forget.
Today is my fellow co-chair's unbirthday. Mm-hmm. Yesterday was his birthday. So sorry we missed it, but we'll make it up for today. We'll take it easy on you.
Okay, I've only had 39 of them, so we're okay.
Oh, that's good. Gosh, that's one less than me. Thank you. Hello to Julie from House Records. Hello to Matt from LIO. Today we will hear a presentation from Corey Feige, Director of Oil and Gas Department of Natural Resources, on Alaska's oil and gas activity. And once she finishes her presentation, we will switch to the Department of Revenue's presentation on the Governor's House Bill 247, Tax Credits, Interest, Refunds, Oil, and Gas. Welcome to the DNR presenters. Please come forward and identify yourself for the record.
I probably won't need this, but good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name's Corey Feige. I'm Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and I have with me today...
Yes, I'm Paul Recker, Petroleum Geologist in the Division of Oil and Gas, and currently the manager of the Resource Evaluation Team there.
Well, before we go, can I say your name?
Yes, sir.
Vice Chair? Thank you, Mr. Hawk. I just want to make sure. Senior moment. Go ahead.
All right, very good. We're pleased to be here with you today to provide you with an update on the oil and gas industry in the state and ongoing activities, some that you may or may not be aware of. We are somewhat sensitive of the time that we have today, so we're just going to roll along, interject with questions at your leisure. If we get toward the end of the presentation and are running a little short of time, we'll refer to you, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, Representative Tarr is present.
All right, very good.
Proceed.
All right. We'll get started, first of all, by taking a look at broad overview of the state. For purposes of today's presentation, we've broken it down into North Slope, Cook Inlet, and then finally the Frontier Basins regions. Within each of these regions, we'll introduce you briefly to our understanding of the resources and reserves, then we'll talk about current activities and new developments, and then we'll take a look specifically at who the companies are that are working in the various regions, and finally have a look at some of the leasing activity and what that may be telling us about the nature and state of the industry in the state. So we'll get started with North Slope.
Right, so Paul Decker, Division of Oil and Gas. Speaking to the North Slope Resource Overview map, this is a little bit of a complicated map. I just want to make sure everybody understands the bits and pieces of it before we get too far along. First, it shows land management areas. You'll see along the bottom of the slide, the National Park Service administers Noatak National Monument, Gates of the Arctic, and the Fish and Wildlife Service administers ANWR, of course. The coastal plain of ANWR there, shown on the right, is not shown in the same color because it's not yet in that permanently federally protected off-limits to oil and gas permanently. Hopefully it will not come to that. The other federal land that makes up a big chunk of the North Slope is the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska on the left. That's about the same size as the state of Indiana there for a sense of scale. So the state lands are those encompassed by the red lines where we have our annual area-wide lease sales. So starting along the shoreline from 0 to 3 miles offshore, we have the Beaufort Sea area-wide sale. In the central North Slope onshore, we have the North Slope area-wide sale, and then to the south, the Foothills sale. And you'll also notice important acreage within the Foothills sale, and also on the extreme western North Slope, that is ASRC surface and subsurface estate. So yet another owner there. The coastal plain area is that area north of the dashed blue line, and you can see that the black dots show a greater exploration well density north of that blue line. So the coastal plain has been somewhat better explored. The Foothills area to the south is a lot lower exploration well density, less exploration there. And what you also notice is two trends of oil and gas accumulations, the oil in green and the gas accumulations in red. The main producing trend, of course, is near the shoreline, within, say, 30 or 40 kilometers of the shoreline, and that's because that's underlain by a huge feature known as the Barrow Arch, which is really, really good petroleum habitat, in essence. There is also a Foothills trend, mostly gas accumulations discovered to date, Umiat being the contrarian there, the exception. So these are the areas, and most of these areas have been assessed independently by the U.S. Geological Survey for their resource potential. So moving on to the next slide, this is rolling up all those federal resource estimates from USGS onshore and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management offshore for Arctic Alaska. So there is one typo here I apologize for, but the bottom line numbers there are correct. The 40 billion barrels of oil as the mean estimate when you combine the onshore and offshore, and 207 or so TCF of undiscovered gas. So again, what these are the mean estimates of a probabilistic distribution accounting for a large degree of uncertainty about how much exactly remains in this category, which is undiscovered, technically recoverable. So these are not reserves. They're not necessarily economically recoverable. And they're just the mean estimates, but this is the sort of assessment that we get. And the typo that I mentioned here is in the fine print at the bottom of where it says mean oil estimate. That should actually be millions of barrels. So that's 15,900 million or 15.9 billion. That's how you get to the 40 billion total. So it's relatively evenly split between onshore and offshore. On the oil side, the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas appear to have more undiscovered oil than the onshore acreage. And then onshore, that would be dominated by about 10 billion barrels in Anwar, about 4.5 billion barrels undiscovered in the central North Slope state lands, and just a little bit in NPRA, less than a billion.
For the record, Representative Heron is here. Proceed.
So I think I've hit everything we need to on that slide, and I'll proceed unless there are questions.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Heron.
Just for clarification, these estimates in the offshore, that's within 200 miles?
Yes, it is. Through the chair, Representative Heron. So moving on to the next slide. This one is now drilling down to what we would consider more along the lines of reserves as opposed to just undiscovered resource. So the top bullet there, we have about 30 trillion cubic feet of associated gas that's estimated to be recoverable in the existing producing primarily that's Prudhoe Bay, and I'm lumping Point Thompson into that. It's about a 3-to-1 ratio, as I'm sure you're aware there. But since the AKLNG line does not exist yet, we don't have a gas transportation system, it's really best to consider those numbers as contingent resource, not as reserves per se, if you're trying to stick to strict definitions. So that's a lot of contingent resource. As far as proved gas reserves.
Please explain.
Explain, sure. The contingent resource is the resource that has been discovered but not yet approved for commercial development, not yet sanctioned, or not yet brought into development. So it's discovered, it may become reserves in the future with a demonstration that those volumes are economic to produce.
And what do you have to do to make it so?
Typically, the threshold, Mr. Chairman, would be a sanction decision, so FID decision in the case of AKLNG.
Okay, thank you. Proceed.
So the second bullet there is drilling down on within the actual currently producing fields, how much of that is in the proved gas reserve category? And this is a number that we can cite publicly from the Energy Information Administration. It's about 6.4 trillion cubic feet of gas. There's a little bit in Cook Inlet, but the bulk of that number there is the North Slope, gas cap gas and solution gas, places like Prudhoe Bay and that sort of thing. So the reason
that
would...
For the record, Representative Olson, I mean... Sorry.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been called worse.
Johnson is here. Sorry.
So that 6.4 trillion cubic feet of reserves would be the portion of the gas in the existing fields that actually has some sort of a market. That's really mostly a local market used on lease or in adjacent fields. Now, looking down at the oil reserves, the EIA credits as of their latest report, which is year-end 2013, gives the North Slope about 2.8 billion barrels of oil reserves in the proved category. So that's not too different from what our division has estimated in recent history from our own decline analysis. Very similar.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you. I really appreciate your presentation, having some numbers in front of us. On these proved resources, do you distinguish between economically recoverable proved and is your definition of proved require being economically recoverable, or is it simply the known proved existent resources?
So, Representative Hawker, through the chair, when we talk about proved reserves, we're specifically in that economically recoverable, expected to be recovered tranche of volumes. So when we say proved reserves, that connotes a 90% certainty that at least that much gas will be produced.
If I might follow up.
Follow up.
And your standard for economically viable recoverable resources?
So through the chair, Representative Hawker, the economic hurdle is considered to be met when, for example, when a project is sanctioned. That's sort of the gold standard when it's sanctioned to go into development.
What you just said, that entire 6.4 trillion feet of associated gas reserves is sanctioned? There's a sanctioned project behind that? It's behind pipe?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, no, I guess that's a little bit of an exception. One of the things about the North Slope that's a little odd, there's its own little local market where gas is sold back and forth between the producers, used on site, things like NGLs, things like, I'm sorry, not NGLs, but MI, makeup, municipal injectant, or fuel use. So that's just demonstrated, I believe, I'd really have to find out from the EIA why they describe that as proved gas reserves, but that would be my understanding, is that it's because it's part of a local market that's functioning there on the North Slope.
And then if I might follow up, then under the oil reserve, the 2.8 billion is oil that is currently in the process of being recovered through a sanctioned project.
Through all the sanctioned fields, through the chair. That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harris.
I just, for clarification, I might have missed it, but the definition of a proven reserve is 90% confidence in it?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, that is correct. 90% certainty that at least that volume will be produced. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just looking at the oil reserves, in the sanctioned projects, that's over the life of that field. And do you have more specifics that can break that number down?
The 30 trillion?
The 2.8 billion barrels of oil. For the known oil reserves?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we don't have that number today with us. We could work that out in an approximate fashion, but the largest part of that is going to be Prudhoe Bay, mm-hmm. and then you're going to go to things like Kaparik and Colville River Unit and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, if you can, I'd appreciate understanding the breakdown better. Thank you.
Proceed.
All right.
I think I'll turn this back over to
Great, thank you.
Director Feige.
So we've had a bit of a look at, high-level look at what the reserves and the resource along or throughout the North Slope is. I'd like to shift gears a bit here and start talking about ongoing activities and new developments that you may or may not be aware of. And I'll try to move through these somewhat quickly. There's quite a few, but if I don't drill down on the details, it is presented for you here on the slide, and feel free to ask any questions. We'll start off. I've just presented these alphabetically. There's no magic to the list other than it's just alphabetic. We'll start with Accumulate Energy, who is a newcomer to the state of Alaska. Accumulate is a partnership between 88 Energy and Burgundy Exploration. They came into the state with Burgundy Exploration acquiring a sizable lease position in 2014 in the central North Slope area, and they're predominantly looking at shale potential. They drilled this past October through December the Icewine number 1 exploration well. That well was placed on the Franklin Bluffs pad, which is a pre-existing gravel pad located along the Dalton Highway about 65 or so miles south of Dead Horse. Based upon the results of the Icewine number 1, Accumulate is now out getting ready to commence a seismic survey across their leasehold in Central North Slope, and they also participated in last November 2015 lease sale, and the partnership took about 130 additional tracts in that sale. So they have a very large acreage position in Central North Slope, again looking predominantly at shale potential. Next, currently out and drilling on the Placer number 3, we have AEX, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of ASRC. They're drilling in the Placer unit. This is an exploration well, and the Placer unit, just for reference purposes, is located immediately south of the Ugarich unit, which is held by Kalis.
South of what?
South of the Ugarich unit, okay. Mr. Chairman. Next, we have BP. BP is one of the longtime foundation producers on the North Slope. They continue to be very aggressive at expanding and maintaining development and production out of the Prudhoe Bay unit. They've completed 8 wells, 46 new sidetracks, and well over 420 workovers just in the IPA in 2015. They completed additional wells in the Lisburn PA and also some on or in-unit seismic in the North Prudhoe Bay also in 2015. Next, Kalis Natural Resources, also a relative newcomer to the state. Kalis entered Alaska in 2013, acquiring Pioneer Natural Resources position in the Ugarich unit. They continue with ongoing development and production at Ugarich. That constitutes 4 to 5 wells drilled each year. All of those wells are long-reach wells and are stimulated through large multi-stage fracks. Kalis has done a lot of work recently optimizing that frack to optimize their recovery and increase their recovery in those wells. You will also remember that Kalis Natural Resources is undertaking the Nuna development, which is a new project development that abuts or it's within the surface facilities sit within the Kuparich unit immediately outside of the Ugarich unit, though the accumulation is within the Ugarich unit itself on the southeastern flank of that unit. Their first production is on track there for late 2017. Last winter, they installed gravel road and gravel pad, but they're not doing any construction work at Nuna this winter. Instead, Kalis with their partner Nordak is over in Smith Bay, drilling right now the second of 2 exploration wells there. Those wells are being drilled from a grounded ice pad in shallow water just offshore. There was one other thing. Oh, I wanted to reference Smith Bay is located about 80 miles or so to the southeast of Barrow, just for reference. Next, we have ConocoPhillips, another very active company on the North Slope. Active in the Colville River unit, as you all know, they initiated production from their CD5 in October of 2015, and that production very rapidly exceeded their expectations. Very encouraged by CD5. They have plans to drill a total of 8 new wells in 2016 on the CD5 development. Conoco also, in late 2015, I believe it was October, November, sanctioned the Greater Moose's Tooth, or GMT-1, which will be a new development located inside the NPRA. And they also continue work at the Kuparuk River unit with the first wells at drill site 2S coming online again in late 2015. And they've got significant drilling planned for 2016 throughout the unit. ExxonMobil, very exciting news. The Point Thompson unit will commence production of NGLs by the middle of May of this year. They have completed the construction of the IPS and the pipeline that connects Point Thompson into the Badami field, and then the Badami pipeline is the connection to TAPS and the SAIL line. And again, they're on track for startup to come. Their deadline is the middle of May, but they tell us that they should be online by the 1st of May. Next, we have Great Bear Petroleum, who's currently out acquiring a very large 3D seismic survey. They are another shale player located just to the north of Accumulate in the central North Slope region. They have plans to re-enter their Alkaid number 1, which they drilled in 2014, and do some additional well work after the completion of their seismic this year. The Alkaid will come next year.
Representative Walker.
And thank you, sir. Ms. Feige, on Great Bear, they were moving ahead very rapidly with this development with the support of Alaska Industrial Development Authority funds. Their third-party financing withdrew after the veto of the state tax credits last year.
Right.
Has that compromised their project or your assessment of its future viability?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I can't speak to whether or not it's compromised the future viability. What we have been told by Great Bear at the division is that it has impacted their schedule under which they're taking future work. The Alkaid number 1 work was originally going to be scheduled for 2016, and that now has been pushed back to 2017. We also know that Great Bear is in the process of bringing other partners into their program on the North Slope.
Thank you, ma'am.
Go ahead.
Proceed.
All right. Thank you. Continuing on, we have Hilcor, who we all know is a very large actor in the Cook Inlet. Hilcor has moved on to the North Slope with the acquisition of the North Star unit. They promptly returned 2 wells there to production. They also acquired a portion of the Milne Point unit, where they are now operator and in partnership with BP. They've drilled 3 new wells and are undertaking some new facility construction there, and they have plans to drill 10 new wells and complete a slew of workovers in 2016. Probably in the news more than any other recently is Repsol and Armstrong. You all, if you saw the petroleum news last Friday, there was a very large article on the Nanushuk project development within the division. We also refer to that as the PICA unit. Repsol and Armstrong formed the PICA unit in June of 2015, and to date, from 2012 to current, they've drilled a total of 12 exploration wells and sidetracks on that acreage. That led to the unit application, and they now have commenced the environmental impact study and their NEPA review for the overall project development. And we would expect if there are no trouble days and no hiccups along the way, that would be 5 to 7 years out, I would estimate, for production to come online. They may well try to fast track that, and certainly Armstrong will keep us posted on that development. Taking a summary look, we wanted to present you with some information over the last, say, 10 years. So we took a look back to 2004, from 2004 to 2014, and rolled up in summary for the North Slope the total number of new exploration and development wells drilled. We have 110 exploratory wells and well branches in that period, and just over 1,600 development and service wells and well branches. In terms of seismic acquisition, seismic data acquisition, and we note here that this is as tax credit data because this is data that the state receives copies of under the rules of the tax credit programs. In terms of 2D and 3D seismic data acquired between 2004 and 2014, you have about 870 line miles of 2D data and just shy of 10,000 square miles of 3D data. And this is both onshore and nearshore grounded ice acquisition.
Representative Hawker, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, with within the recent years of sitting on this committee, we used to get a really nifty, colorful bar graph that showed by year the number of the rig count, actually, of those that were, you know, exploration rigs, exploration wells drilled, development wells drilled. And what I do recall is that within a very few years ago, I think we had a winter that there was like no exploratory wells drilled. And just, and obviously we've got some pretty good numbers here, but that's a 10-year. Is there any way you could dig back out of your archives that rig count and well count data and do a updated graph for us?
Absolutely. Representative Hawker, through the chair, we can. In fact, for purposes of just summary and time here today, we rolled it up into totals, but we can absolutely send you those graphs. We've got them. That'll do a by-year breakdown through that period of our total well count.
Okay, and thank you. And it was just dawning on me. It may have been you. It may have been AOGCC that did the graphs I'm thinking of, but you know what,
exactly.
What I'm looking for.
Yep, I do. Mm-hmm. AOGCC. I'll just make a note. Great. Okay. So, moving on, taking a look at who are the companies that are out working the North Slope, investing in the North Slope, and what does this tell us about the evolution of the basin, if you will, or the evolution of the region. We have a very healthy and robust cross-section of companies working on the North Slope. I think fundamentally what that tells us is that the industry still views the resource endowment and the environment of investing in Alaska as being a good place to be. In terms of our large companies, these are predominantly our foundation producers, our big legacy producers. And for our purposes of breakout here, we've classified these as companies with greater than a $40 billion market capitalization. On that list, we've got BP, Chevron, Conoco, Eni or Eni, which is an Italian major. We have Exxon, and then we have Shell. In behind the majors are our large independents and mid-sized companies. These would be the Armstrongs and their subsidiary 70 and 148. We have Anadarko. We do have a typo here, and I apologize. Apache is not on the North Slope. They are only in Cook Inlet. So please cross that one through if you would. We've got Kalis Natural Resources, as I mentioned, and the rest on the list. And at the bottom there, we have Repsol, who's partnered with Armstrong in the Nanushuk development at the Pikki unit.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Heron.
Yeah, small question, but within the department, isn't Exxon now what they call an ultra major? I mean, they're really not a large major anymore.
Representative Heron, through the chair, I think you could absolutely classify they and Shell with the acquisition of the BG Group as ultra majors. They clearly are greater than $40 billion market capitalization.
Thank you.
Moving on quickly, our cadre of small independents that moves into a region or a basin as the exploration cycles and as production there begins to mature, and you can see that we have quite a list of small companies active and investing on the North Slope. Many of these companies will partner together in developments. For example, we have Accumulate Energy, which is a partnership of Burgundy Exploration and 88 Energy. Burgundy also holds leases independently of the partnership. We have Brooks Range Development, which is undertaking the Mustang development, and their partners are on this list as well. They have Caracal, they have Ram's Horn, and a number of others. So the nature of these smaller companies is that they will be very fluid. Their numbers will grow when commodity prices are high, and their numbers will shrink a bit as commodity prices fall because they partner up, they sell their assets between themselves. Some, it just becomes, you know, too rich for their blood, so to speak, too high a cost environment, and they'll sell or partner with others to manage those economic realities. But overall, we've got a broad cross-section and a good healthy cross-section of players still working on the North Slope. This is borne out if we look at the North Slope leasing activity.
Representative Hopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Corey, back to that last slide. Sure. You know, one of the things we've seen, and frankly, some big name issues in the Cook Inlet, where we've had people come in, incented to be there, but really weren't able to perform, weren't able to, in my opinion, provide the state the proper assurance for their ability to remediate any inadvertent damage they may cause. Basically, their financial and we only call it environmental responsibility, mm-hmm. Gets called into question. Can you give me some assurance of what you are doing or what we as a state are doing to be sure that the folks up there on the North Slope are economically capable and certainly have the ability to provide the sort of due diligence that we request, we'd want to have of someone undertaking these sort of activities?
Absolutely. Representative Hawker, through the chair, what the Division of Oil and Gas administers a program on what's called DR&R, or Dismantlement, Removal, and Restoration. DR&R is the end of economic life closure period for fields that are in production. And DR&R includes the removal and remediation of facilities, infrastructure, roads, pads, etc. Under the leases, the lessees, and in this case the unit operators and their partners, are required to work with the state at the end of life in DR&R planning. And the state will work with them determining which assets the state sees as valuable that we may want to keep and carry forward, or which of the assets should be removed and the areas remediated. That final plan is put together, and there's a DR&R estimate that is maintained throughout the life of the field. And what we are doing with our operators now is, as leases are transferred and new parties come in or there's some shuffling of the interests, they will work with the division, and we establish what we call a financial assurances agreement, which is a DR&R agreement, looking down the road to the end of that field life so that we have either bonding or they're paying into, as production develops, they begin paying into what we call a sinking fund, so that there is a pool of money available to undertake that DR&R activity at the end of the field life, and the state does not find itself in a position where a company may falter or fail and end up going under or going away before the DR&R's work is done. There is, if you will, a kitty or a fund that's made available for undertaking that work should we run into that circumstance.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, and appreciate the whole demobilization restoration work concept here, the end of field life, post-field life concerns. What about, again, during your current activities? Again, some of the issues have been with these smaller entities is, I think we may have, in some cases, seen compromised safety practices, and literally the challenges that can come from an inability to financially complete their work up front, let alone the backside of field life. And you're also focused on the front end of field life?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, we are. And in fact, in unit activities as well as leasehold activities, the division has the authority to request performance bonds in order to ensure that not only is the activity undertaken, but that the activity is then remediated on the backside. As you know, AOGCC, for anything downhole, has a bonding requirement as well that would cover the plugging and abandonment of wells that are, say, exploration wells or wells that may be abandoned at some point in their life. If a company can't perform, then that bond is exercised, and the division has that same authority, and we utilize that same authority for the ongoing early stage activities.
Thank you, ma'am. I very much appreciate that.
All right, so if we look quickly again at the leasing trends, and really what we wanted to show you here was generalized activity levels and interest in taking leases since the beginning of the area-wide leasing program. This first slide shows you the North Slope Foothills region, which, as Paul mentioned, is predominantly a gas-prone area just north of the Brooks Range. You can see area-wide leasing began in 2001. There was a bit of a flurry of activity with lease-taking in that area in the first couple of years. These would have been leases with a primary term of 10 years. And you can see over the life of leasing within the North Slope Foothills, there's not been that much activity. We believe that a lot of this has to do with the remoteness. There's no infrastructure. You're a long darn way from Dead Horse down there. And it's very high cost operating, and I believe until we have an AKLNG or some sort of means to get that gas resource to a market, we'll see subdued activity in the Foothills region. Looking at the Beaufort Sea, and this would be 0 to 3 miles out in that red outlined area on the first map that Paul showed you, you can see that over the years, and area-wide leasing began in 2000 in the Beaufort Sea, we've had a fairly robust and consistent level of leasing in the Beaufort Sea. We've noted that the taking of leases here, and again, these would have been 10-year primary terms on the leases. So if it was leased in 2000, if it wasn't developed and was allowed to come back into the lease sale, it would not have been available again until 2011, and you see that spike. We believe also here that leasing for the Beaufort Sea is somewhat hampered by the fact that beyond 3 miles, the federal government is not consistent in how frequently they're willing to lease that acreage. So there is a bit of an artificial boundary at 3 miles. If you're an explorer and make a discovery out near that margin and it extends out past the 3 mile mark, you're into federal territory, and without a lease to continue, it's just too risky. You don't own the resource. And so that clearly has an impact on leasing in the Beaufort Sea. Finally, we'll take a quick look at the North Slope area-wide leasing activity. The area-wide leasing program commenced in 1998 here. Again, 10-year primary terms on the leases here. And these track oil prices pretty consistently, knowing that companies are making those leasing decisions and setting those finances aside, designating those funds, you know, at least a year to sometimes 2 years or more in advance. But we see, again, a robust, you know, ready sort of crew that's coming to participate in North Slope. This indicates that the interest in and the belief in the endowment and the resource remains.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huff.
And thank you very much. You know, Corey, you indicated you felt these trend lines here were largely tracking oil prices. Is that really what explains this, you know, very significant, you know, profound growth from 2007 to 2011, then the fall off in 12, but then that incredible spike in 2014? And that 2014 spike seems contrary to a claim of that kind of a proportionate increase in oil prices.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, one quick comment, and then I'll you go ahead, Paul, and I'll add mine.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, Paul Decker, Division of Oil and Gas. I did want to point out that just a couple of things here. Starting in 2010, we had our very first shale play bidding, and that was Great Bear. They came in and plopped down something like 100 bids of that 117. So that was a big wake-up call to us and to the industry globally, you know, nationally at least, that Alaska may have a shale play. And because of that flurry of activity that we saw in 2010, by 2011 we had adopted a strategy whereby we actually took our former, what was it, 3 by 3 mile, you know, so 9 square mile tracts, and in the vicinity of the shale play, the area that we deemed geologically appropriate to the shale play, we decided to cut our existing lease blocks or tracts into 4 smaller tracts. And that was a very deliberate decision to encourage them to protect the state's interest in order for large areas to not be held without actually producing being penetrated by successful wells. So in other words, you'd need a well on each lease to hold it forever. And so by making smaller tracts, that would mean they'd have to drill more wells to hold the same acreage. And that's appropriate to the shale reservoir behavior. You don't drain 9 square miles in one well. So that, from then on, we had that same smaller tract schema in place. So in 2011, 140 tracts were sold, and if you imagine that, part of that's because to lease the same number of acres, they had to bid 4 tracts, not just one. And again, in 2014, the 212 tracts offered, a lot of those were people like 88 Energy and Accumulate folks coming in, as well as, I think, Repsol bidding in some other areas. But just keep in mind that partitioning of lease tracts into smaller blocks meant for selling a larger number of tracts.
Chair.
I'll go ahead. But also.
Oh, fine.
On that point, through the chair, was that done, Mr. Decker, administratively? And can you just give us a little background on the policy to create, I guess, four units out of what had been one? Is that what you said?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, not four units, but four lease tracts.
Four lease tracts.
Out of a single tract, okay. Right. And again, the reason for that is that shale wells, you know, they drill a horizontal well and they frack it and so forth, but one well can only drain a very limited area right in the immediate vicinity of that well. There's no way in a shale play that one well could adequately drain a 9-square-mile lease tract. So we found it to be, it was a carefully thought through decision in the division and with the commissioner's blessing that for the future sales beginning in 2011, that would be part of the terms and conditions.
Okay. I mean, it begs the question, if I may, that what you've just stated would have been true 50 years ago, right? So why the policy change? Except if you were finding that there was someone being dilatory or
through the chair, Representative Josephson, the reason for the change is that now we were looking at shale plays as opposed to conventional plays.
Okay.
So. The Great Bear came in, and then other companies, Royale and 88 Energy, Burgundy, they've come in and have been very forthright about saying we're here to try and develop the shale plays,
okay.
And so that by itself requires a different way of looking at the reservoirs and potential reservoirs.
Thank you.
Sure.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that was a really, really wise decision made with the great difference between shale development and the rest of the North Slope here, and I really commend you on having the foresight on that one. But so that sort of your change in philosophy of structuring these lease tracts, that would have been essentially accomplished and done 2010, 2011. That can't account then for that incredible spike in 2014. Do you have any sense of what accounts for the spike in 2014? And then nextly, we're into 2016. That's past history. Is there a 15 for this graph?
Representative Hawker, through the chair. First of all, to your point about the spike in 2014, and yes, we can make 2015 available. We haven't finished issuing all of those leases yet, so we don't have fully adjudicated numbers. Hence, they're not included in this, but yes, we will update that graph for you. Speaking to the spike in 2014, I think, first of all, a couple of things, and I'm sure you all know this well. The relationship...
Probably not. I would assume.
It is a complex relationship and kind of a complex thought process that goes into making the investment decision to take lease assets, looking toward the future and planning for that exploration work, and more importantly, the funding of that exploration work. We believe that in 2014, prior to that precipitous crash that started in late 2014 with oil prices, bearing in mind that these decisions would have been made a year or better in advance to take a significant acreage position, the planning would have been done, they would have pulled the trigger. But clearly what else was going on in that time period was there was a tax change, and that was the implementation of SB 21 or the MAPA, which I believe became effective in January of 2014, and I'm sure that conversation leading up to that would have been factored in to decisions by companies as well. We can only speculate, and I would just encourage you to talk to the companies and the lessees directly about some of those decisions that are made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, ma'am.
All right, great. Okay. All right. Terrific. We'll move on to Cook Inlet.
So again, Paul Decker from Oil and Gas, just to introduce the Cook Inlet Resource and Reserves Overview. This is a map that comes right out of the U.S. Geological Survey's 2011 resource assessment for, again, we're talking undiscovered, technically recoverable oil and gas. Not reserves, not necessarily commercial, but just what's the undiscovered resource out there that could be extracted with today's technology. So they came back with, frankly, a fairly robust estimate on Cook Inlet, both from an oil and a gas perspective. They believe that the basin still has something like 600 million barrels of oil to be discovered, something like a total of 19 trillion cubic feet of gas to be discovered. That's broken out here between about 14 TCF of conventional gas,
split between tertiary and Mesozoic reservoirs, and about 5 TCF of unconventional gas. And that's split between tight Mesozoic sandstones and the coal bed methane play that has never quite gotten off the ground in Cook Inlet, but is still there with resource potential. So then if we look away from the USGS estimates and at work that my group in the Division of Oil and Gas just put together last summer and released in late September, the current natural gas reserves in the basin, so now we are talking about gas in legacy fields that we have a 50% or better percent likelihood of producing. So we call those 2P, or proven and probable reserves. That estimate is 1.18 trillion cubic feet. So that's not too different than the number that we came up with about 5 years ago. It's a little bit higher, as a matter of fact. And so there's got to be some plus or minus in the estimates, but I think what that says is that we're holding relatively steady on our reserves base with the investment that's going on in the basin. In fact, probably increasing our reserve base slightly, even though we've been producing gas at the same time. So it's a good trend. We don't know how long exactly that can continue to be the case, the reserves growth, but it's certainly a good trend. And then just in the southern part of the map here, beyond the limits of the area-wide sale or the state lands, down here where the words Cook Inlet are written, that is Outer Continental Shelf, so that would be assessed by the BOEM, and they give that area a mean undiscovered resource potential of about 1.2 trillion cubic feet, as well as some oil, but mostly gas.
Okay. So taking a look at ongoing activities and upcoming new developments in Cook Inlet, and in lieu of time, we'll move right along here. We've got Apache Alaska Corporation, who came into the inlet in 2011 with a very aggressive acreage taking in the Cook Inlet lease sale. They continue their extensive seismic acquisition program both onshore and offshore, and are in the process of permitting for a new well, which could be drilled in late 2016. ConocoPhillips recently announced the sale of their interest in the Beluga River unit to the Municipality of Anchorage, or MLNP, and Chugach Electric. And Fury Operating System would be the newest producer in Cook Inlet at the Kitchen Lights unit. In the summer of 2015, they set their offshore monopod platform, completed all of their onshore facilities and pipelines, and then commenced first gas production from the Kitchen Lights unit in December of 2015. They're now in the process of bringing up a second larger jackup rig. It's on the water now, scheduled to reach the inlet middle part of May. And they needed that larger piece of equipment for drilling of the development wells off the monopod. It needed to be able to cantilever over the top and anchor very securely. The smaller Spartan 151 rig would be floating somewhat on the tide. It would be anchored only by barges and would leave them with only about a foot to a foot and a half of clearance over the monopod. Very dangerous situation. So Fury made the decision to contract the second larger jackup rig, which will come to the inlet, and then they then will utilize that rig over the next couple of years to drill out the full field development and undertake some additional exploration within the unit area. Bluecrest Energy, who has the Cosmo unit, they will be bringing a large ground-based drill rig for extended reach wells into the inlet, scheduled for arrival in April of this year, and they will produce oil from the Cosmo unit from onshore facilities rather than from offshore. They would like to undertake gas development. If they do choose to undertake the investment for development of the gas cap, they'll do that from offshore and could potentially use that smaller Spartan 151 jackup rig that is currently still in the inlet. If they choose not to proceed in the very near term with that gas development, then the Spartan 151 will leave the inlet.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The jackup rig that's being brought in, was that in a layup situation like the Endeavor was that Buccaneer brought in, or was that a functioning fully operational, well, at the rig at the time, and where did it come from?
Right. Representative Seaton, through the chair, if memory serves, and I can get you the exact details, Fury reported to us that rig is coming out of Singapore and has been actively drilling on prospects there, deep water prospects there. So it was an active rig. It had not been, you know, torn down and stacked out in storage as the Endeavor had been. And it's on a vessel now coming out of Singapore.
Mm-hmm. And follow up. When the Endeavor came, there were it had been out of the water for a month or so, so it was okay. But there were actually encrusted mollusks and other things on those jackup rigs when it came into Kachemak Bay. Has there been inspections for invasive species on coming in on that rig?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I don't know the answer to the question of inspection for invasive species, but I do know that AOGCC has a robust rig inspection and rig certification program for new rigs coming into Alaska, both ground-based and offshore, and they'll be responsible for doing that initial sign-off prior to operations. We can certainly find out if invasive species, given the history with the Endeavor, will now be part of that inspection process.
Mr. Chairman, I sure appreciate that because, you know, there's nothing worse than getting held up by court filings and those kind of things. We don't have currently, I don't believe we have a statutory requirement, but, you know, we could really get in holding things up unnecessarily. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate you getting that for me.
Representative Hawker?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, Corey, I'm getting about half a step ahead of your next slide, but
sure.
Your next slide is just, you know, really showing the significant amount of work that Hillcorp is doing in the inlet. And I'm just wondering, is it possible, do you have to, just off the top of your head, and I'm not asking for specific, you know, really tight numbers, but what proportion of the production coming out of the inlet today and what you're anticipating to come out of the inlet today is kind of allocable to each of these participants? And can you in any way kind of give us a guideline on how much of that proportion is oil and how much of it's gas?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, will drill down on that, but just notionally from the companies that we're presenting here in the activity update, and Paul, jump in here if you have something more specific. Apache is not producing. Conoco is producing gas. And Fury is gas only. Blue Crest will be oil, but nothing on production currently. Hillcore, clearly in production. And currently, in fact, I get a monthly update on production levels. At present, Cook Inlet oil is up to just shy of 18,000 barrels a day, which is the highest level that it has been at since 2005 and has been in steady increase since 2009. And I think it is safe to say that we can attribute that increase in production to Hillcore's activities.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I'm not seeing West Eagle on here. I know that there's just been people calling around actually in the Homer area that they're going to be coming out and doing seismic workovers and those kind of things on the West Eagle. There was Buccaneers' previous attempt out there. Is that located on one of these, or is that just not on the radar yet?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I believe that West Eagle, and correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, was acquired by
AIX,
exactly. And they're on our list of operating companies. We have no active applications before the division at the present time. So if they are planning work, they haven't brought it to our attention at this point in time.
Okay, and follow up.
So
would they need to come to you before they're doing seismic work?
Yeah, okay. Representative Seaton, through the chair, they'd require either a miscellaneous land use permit, or if it's on an oil and gas lease, then they're going to require a lease plan of operations approval from us as well.
Okay, thank you.
And so quickly just continuing, we saw Hillcore, the High Points, working diligently throughout the basin, bringing both gas and oil production online. Notably, in late 2015, they did acquire the Middle Ground Shoal assets from XTO Energy, which was offshore. Those assets are in Southern Cook Inlet. That included onshore facilities in one platform. And Hillcore reports that they have a projection of spending about $120 million in the Cook Inlet region in 2016. So again, just in summary, in terms of exploration and development wells in that period, this time the period between 2010 and 2014. And in our data evaluation, we chose to take a look at that. That seemed more germane to this discussion. 2010 would have been just right before the Cook Inlet Recovery Act came into play. And during the period of 2010 to 2014, we had 24 exploration wells and then 65 development service wells and well branches drilled. In terms of seismic acquired in the inlet, again, data that comes into the division via the tax credit programs. And this time in the time period from 2004 through 2014, which takes in that entire time period where the division would have been receiving credit-related data. In terms of 2D line miles, we had just about 725 and roughly 650 square miles of 3D seismic acquired. And this is a combination of onshore and offshore acquisition. Again, who's working the inlet? We have one large major left in the inlet, and that is ConocoPhillips. Conoco has announced that the sale of the Beluga River unit, and they also have their North Cook Inlet unit assets, I believe, still for sale. They had offered both at the same time. Mid-sized companies operating the independents are Hillcore and Apache Alaska. Hillcore has done a fine job of driving their operating costs in the inlet down. Because they own such a suite of properties, they are able to aggregate their activities into areas around the basin or into type of activity. So rather than drilling one well or two well, which is the highest cost kind of program you can have, they aggregate those and they drill 10 wells or do 15 or 20 workovers at a time. In doing so, they're able to get, if you will, volume pricing from the local service sector. If they're not pleased with the pricing they can get locally, they've been able to successfully bring additional service companies into the inlet, entities that they've successfully worked with in the lower 48, so they've actually grown a little competition in that service sector in the inlet as well. And that's been a very successful model for them, and we fully anticipate that they'll employ those same practices on the North Slope, and we hope to see them be successful at driving costs down there as well. Our list of small independent companies in the inlet, while a shorter list, is still a good, robust crew of companies. Again, a lot of these companies are partnered in developments around the inlet. You see AIX on here that you mentioned from West Eagle. We have Nordak. Nordak's been a longtime player in the inlet. Fury operating Alaska with the KLU and, of course, Bluecrest. Fury's partners are Corsair and Cornucopia, who you also see on this list as well. In terms of Cook Inlet leasing activity and leasing trends, this since the commencement of area-wide leasing in Cook Inlet in 1999 through this one has 2015. That was the May lease sale. A couple of notable things. Again, you can see when Apache came into the inlet with the big spike in 2011. And we continue to have a robust presence and a robust level of activity, generally speaking, across the inlet. Interesting to note that leases in Cook Inlet have a primary term of 7 years as opposed to 10 years, and that's because the exploration to development cycle within Cook Inlet is shorter than it is on the North Slope. It's closer to infrastructure, still difficult to get to things on the west side, but there are some roads established, and so it's easier to undertake activities, and you have less of a seasonal control on access in the Cook Inlet than you do on the North Slope. You don't have to wait for tundra openings and things of that nature.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, Corey, we can see in this slide where, let's kind of look at 2004 to 2009, we have a absolutely precipitous decline of activity in the Cook Inlet. Clearly, you know,
jumping 2010, 2011, of course, you identified as Apache particularly, but the essentially the continued fairly robust activity in the inlet out there. It's a question from the DNR standpoint, because it's an issue that's relevant to the discussion going on in this committee with regard to proposals from DOR. Mm-hmm. And it is, do you have any sense of the how efficacious the financial incentives that were awarded in the passage of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act were in turning around that decline from 2004 to 2009 and sustaining the level of investment currently? I mean, the question is, do we need to have, you know, are these incentives still working, or, again, as proposed by Department of Revenue, is there any sense from your, is, you guys do the forecasting now. I understand that, in fact, you have all the forecasting, and DOR is no longer part of the forecasting. Do you, how would the passage of the bill that's in debate in this committee affect your forecasting for the inlet?
Okay. Representative Hawker, through the chair, a couple of different questions, and I'll address the first part and then let Paul address the portion on forecasting, because his group, the RE section, is working with revenue on that for future forecasting work. I think, first of all, we can see in Cook Inlet when Cook Inlet actually stopped being oversupplied and started actually behaving like a supply and demand driven market. And you see that really start to take hold in about 2002. And there was a fairly massive, if you will, that's probably an overstatement, but there was a robust entrance of companies into Cook Inlet because now you could actually sell your gas and there was a market for the gas. Clearly, over time, and in Cook Inlet, and it is a unique market. It is not attached to the lower 48. It's not Henry Hub today, I think, is $1.87 or something like that, and we're about $6.56 or something for the WACOG in Cook Inlet. So we're very separate. But our market tends to become constrained fairly rapidly because the majority of our demand comes from those utilities. And we have, over time, had large industrial anchors like Agrium. And looking forward, we could again see Agrium, and in a few years, we could hopefully see a Donlin Creek mine also needing to source gas out of the inlet. So absolutely, I think that those market dynamics have played a role over time in Cook Inlet, and we were clearly, as was part of the discussion in the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, we were behind the power curve in terms of investment and drilling to make sure that we had enough ready supply of gas to meet our base utility needs, and that then precipitated the Cook Inlet recovery, and we saw, I think, an upswing in activity associated with that. I think we're seeing a couple of things leading into the downturn in 2015. Again, a little bit of market constraint going on. We're beginning to see our utilities out to, I think most recently we've got some five-year contracts. Utilities really like, as you all know, to have contracts out at 10 years as a minimum. And, you know, in the last few years, the best they've been able to do is 18 months, maybe 2 years. And then very recently, we've seen a few five-year contracts trickle out. So I think we're seeing the effects of a bit of market constraint here as well. And Paul, do you want to address the
Paul Decker, Oil and Gas. I was actually thinking just in terms of addressing the first question, were the credits efficacious? I think it's no doubt that credit helped stimulate some of the drilling activity and reserve replacement activity. No question. I would say there are also a couple of other factors. You just touched on the price, Corey. I think that has been a leveraging factor. The Hillcorp takeover is another pretty obvious point. You have a single company that can manage the basin as almost a portfolio, you know, take a broad view of economies of scale and things like that. And one other factor I just wanted to point out is the gas storage. Now that we have expansion of the gas storage at Singsa, with Singsa on board, that helps provide a little bit more incentive for companies to get out there and drill a well that they may not be able to sell the gas directly to the utilities year-round, but they can sell it into storage. So that helps motivate that drilling of additional wells. As for the forecasting going forward, the Division of Oil and Gas, my section with the reservoir engineers, will be working with our commercial section and some of the people in the tax division at DOR I think their contribution is still important. They have the rapport and the history of going to the companies to speak off the record about confidential issues for projects that are under development or under evaluation. And our goal now, though, is to don't want to steal their thunder, but our goal is to prepare a more probabilistic or stochastic forecast that recognizes the uncertainty at every level, whether it's the currently producing, the under development, or the under evaluation.
We have a question from Representative Oyo.
If I could ask one quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
And I really appreciate you talking about, again, really moving forward on some of these probabilistic models, taking into consideration all of the appropriate input variables. When might something like that be available to help us judge the true impacts and consequences on production volumes of the tax proposal that's in front of us?
Through the chair, Representative Parker, this change is intended to take place in time for the fall revenue forecast.
Fall revenue forecast.
Right.
And I make that very clear, Mr. Chair. You do not intend to have, you are the forecasting entity for the state of Alaska with a tiny amount of forecasting done at revenue, but we, the legislature, will not have forecast information on the consequences of House Bill 247 until the fall revenue forecast.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, unless it's contained in the spring DOR source book update, that's my understanding.
Correct. And
Representative Olson has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, welcome back. And when you mentioned market constraints, were you referring to the RCA cutting back on the length of the gas sales to Japan?
Representative Olson, through the chair, I think that certainly had an impact at the time. I think it was pretty clear that when RCA lifted that restriction, we saw a lot more fluidity and flow, if you will, in the development of those resource or the local utility contracts. And speaking specifically about, are you, as a follow-up for your question, are you talking specifically about the export to Japan through the Nikiski facility?
Yeah.
And I apologize, Representative Olson. I don't have an answer for that. I'd have to look into that. But I think once RCA in general lifted some of the constraints that we saw broadly across the inlet, we saw more activity. We saw, again, it was one less barrier to development and sale of the product.
You know, it was less demand as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I'm trying to figure out the five-year contract period means that people bringing gas on right now, unless they have some other sales, are sitting there with gas not ready to sell if there's a five-year filling of the market, unless Donlin Creek or something else comes online. So, first of all, is that a correct analysis of that with a if the market is fully subscribed and with a five-year contract, people that bring gas on right now, unless it would go through the liquefaction, through ConocoPhillips and the Nikiski plant, there's really not a sale for that gas.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the five-year contract that I was referring to that we have seen was for one of the South Central utilities, and it doesn't actually start until 2018. So it was forward-looking past the expiration of another contract. But I think your assessment is correct. We have heard from FURI that they will need to scale the pace at which they do their development based upon their ability to sell their gas, and that, you know, it makes perfect financial sense that is the driver. If they can't sell the gas and recoup their cost on drilling the wells and doing the development activity, it does become a hindrance to that development work and the timely fashion in which that development gets done.
Thank you. Anyone follow up?
And
the question on changing your modeling, I'm kind of hearing that your modeling might be intended to say what would the impact of credits or not credits this bill that we're talking about have on that modeling. does your modeling from Vision Oil Gas, is that going to incorporate those kind of elements and as how that would influence actual wells drilled?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, to be really honest, the question of how is HB 247 going to impact the forecast has not really come up in our technical discussions with DOR about how we intend to pursue forecasting.
And I would just add on Representative Seaton through the chair, and this goes back to Representative Hawker's question. The modeling that the Division of Oil and Gas undertakes, doing the assessment of the impacts of the tax credits and the costing, that's outside the scope of what the division's commercial section normally does. We don't have access to the cost data. The Division of Revenue has access to that data. We do notionally keep a working inventory, I guess, if you will, or sense of how healthy production is at the various units around the state. So we know when in a low price stress environment like we are now, we might see some production taken off of line, or might we be in an extended period looking at a shortening of the economic life of a field. But I think the kind of analysis that the committee has been asking for is what Director Alper and his team have been working on and are planning to present over the next couple of days. But that type of analysis on bill impacts would not be something that the division would normally take up in the course or scope of our activities, because we simply don't have access to that costing information.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that we didn't have expectations that the report that we were going to get was on something other than their modeling. So thanks.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you. And again, Craig, I really appreciate that. But again, you guys are the experts. You guys are the ones tasked with doing these production projections. Does it cause you any concerns that you're trying to project in a vacuum by not having access to the information that would seem really relevant to these production levels? Your charts show us here very distinct changes in leasing and resultant production as a result of policy calls made in major tax increases and major tax decreases in the state over recent years. Do you have any comfort in your ability to really do accurate modeling here without better information as to the consequences of these policy decisions?
And Representative Hawker, through the chair, no, you make an absolutely valid point that we need access to good information and to work with revenue in making those projections. We try to derive our information and our look at how industry is doing by talking to industry itself through the course of our POD discussions or our unit development discussions, et cetera. And they're very forthcoming, and I think a lot of you have heard from them in the interim as well, on their perceived impacts to what they have planned. But, again, we are in a bit of a box because of the information, and that I think that's where I'd have to leave it.
Okay. Thank you for the moment.
Very good. Okay. So, now, Mr. Chairman, I would ask you, we're at 2:15. We can stop at Frontier Basins, which is, rather than dealing with leasing, deals with exploration licensing, and this is very much the frontier area. We can stop here and let Director Alper come up and continue his presentation, and then just provide these slides and answer any questions to the committee after the fact. It's your preference.
Is that okay?
If DNR is going to be stepping down, I'd like one final capstone question.
Sure.
And I realize you don't speak for the commissioner or the commissioner designee here, but does DNR have any position or counsel for us on House Bill 247, the legislation that's in front of us?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I would think that from DNR's standpoint and the division's standpoint, I would just stress that balance is the key. We have to keep a balance moving forward between exploration and ongoing production. The exploration wells of today and the exploration successes of today and the next 5 years or so become the production 10, 15, 20 years down the road. So where we really want to focus in and be very, you know, on the spot and somewhat myopic. I think we have to be cautious not to take that tact, because we have to keep our eye on what's going to be our production 5, 10, 15, you know, 20 years, as I said, down the road. I think that we can absolutely say that incentive credit programs work. We saw it work in Cook Inlet, but again, it comes back to balance. It's a balance of what can the state afford to sustain going forward. And I think that we have to keep talking to our companies, hearing from them, because that's going to be the response to us all as we work through this and try to make that decision of what can the state afford to do going forward, trying to keep our eye on what is our production source going to be, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
Thank you. I think I heard you say keep your eye on the ball. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. All right, terrific. We'll you have all of the slides. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Just before you're going to go, and I was just looking through the slides, so we can come back to that later. But one of the things that you and I spoke about was also, you know, in making sure that we're holding lease sales so that we, you know, always have that ongoing activity. And so I guess trying to piece together, you know, the previous comments about the balance with that idea and sort of the influence of price, the very low price environment we're in right now, you know, how to kind of think about all of those things together, if you have any comments about that, and how the departments, you know, at least from the lease sale side of things, planning to make sure, you know, things are moving forward.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, we undertake, as Paul alluded to earlier, we undertake a review of our terms and conditions within about 6 months prior to each lease sale, be it North Slope or Cook Inlet. And the team sits down and takes a look at the Cook Inlet, for example, from the standpoint of the resource and the reserve and what we understand about it. We look at the commercial side of things. What's the price projection? You know, how supplied is the Cook Inlet Basin, and all of those complex factors that can come to bear on the behavior of companies and their participation in the lease sales. We then set the terms and conditions for each lease sale, and we have the authority, the commissioner has the authority, to raise or lower minimum entry bids to reflect what we believe may be stress points on the industry. For example, you don't want a minimum entry bid that's too high in a price stress market when you know people just don't have, or companies don't have, a lot of surplus cash sitting around. Where you want them, it's in the state's interest for companies to take that acreage and be able to hang on to it and be doing their exploration planning through the period of downturn, and then be positioned to really ride the wave, so to speak, as prices begin to come back up again. And so those are all factors that the division sits down and thinks about and works through in making our recommendation to the commissioner to keep, to hope to engender and establish a robust level of leasing activity across the state. And I think it's important that, you know, that conversations like this certainly come into play in those assessments of those terms and conditions.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Corey, I've been thinking about what the vice chair asked you and listening to your response. So a two-part question. So we heard earlier from revenue that there was lots of conversations within the administrative team, and of course you're one of the team members. Was your view, or your opinions, I guess, of this proposed legislation, do you believe that you were able to get that message across to the administration of how this will have an impact on industry? And the second part of the question is, you said that you've talked to the industry all the time. Could you share with a couple of points what they've articulated to you, their concerns on this proposed legislation to a DNR employee?
Sure, absolutely. Representative Heron through the chair. First of all, Director Alper and I did talk, you know, several times during the development of the legislation. He would call and ask questions about existing credits on the books, how long they've been used, and did we perceive that there would be an impact to industry if certain older credits were repealed. We did talk about, the potential revenue would ask us what our opinion was on how we thought industry may react if a credit program went away. We were not intimately involved. I and my division were not intimately involved in the development of the bill that is before you, but we did add input as it was, as it was asked of us from revenue and Director Alper's team. In answering your second question, what we have heard from industry, and just by way of a couple of examples, the changes in tax credits changes in taxes generally are lumped into the bucket, if you will, with industry of cost. And so when you're looking at your overall project development or working in a specific area, you've got your costs. If your costs go up, you need to be able to compensate for that. At a time when prices are very low, that sets off some alarm bells, and we've certainly heard that from industry, the concern over making, big changes to tax policy at a time that prices are very low and at a time when prices are not expected to come back into the $100 realm anytime soon. We've also heard from those companies who are actively engaged in ongoing developments. They're concerned that tax credit programs on which they're currently planning their expenditures and factoring those into the equation, that those halfway through a development drilling program would go away. And their world changes at that point. And they, again, it's coming back to that constant theme of stability and what can they expect. And they need to be able to plan more than 6 months out. They need to be able to plan a year or 2 years out in order to line up their funding and in order to ensure that they can undertake those activities without interruption.
Just a follow up for that. Basically a comment. I appreciate that. I think that is, in listening to my colleagues and talking to others in the building, is, where can we, if there is a change, where do we stop it, but not impact the ones that are in play? That's, I think, is a really important part of this factoring in this amendments to this proposed legislation. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Representative Cheatham.
Thank you. I think we got almost two different conversations, one on gas, especially Cook Inlet gas, and the rest on oil. But considering gas for a minute, and, like you said, $1.87 or something like that, Henry Hub, we've got worldwide LNG floating around at less than spot we've long-term contracts less than $5 spot and that kind of thing. Is there any place in the world that is better profit margin than Cook Inlet for producing and selling gas that you know of at $6.85, or winter time can be higher than that, in the gas market in the United States or worldwide?
Representative Seaton through the chair. Off the top of my head, and I have on the phone with me Ed King from our commercial section. So, Ed, you can hear me. If you can think of something, jump in. But off the top of my head, I think the answer clearly is no. We're at $6.50 in Cook Inlet. We're at $1.87 in the lower 48. Currently, Japan is less than a half of what it was just two or three years ago in terms of LNG import. Cook Inlet is a good place to be for being in the gas business. Our problem is that we lack those industrial anchors, those large consumers or larger consumers that, just like in the power sector, to shoulder the development of a big power plant, you need a good industrial anchor. Your industrial anchor allows you to then generate power at a steady rate, and then you can feed others in to the power stream once your plant is up and going. And I think much that same model applies to gas in Cook Inlet. We've we've got great resource, and we've got a lot of companies doing a lot of good work, and we just, at the present time, run out of offtakes.
So we're talking about the market is the determiner of what's happening in Cook Inlet, but that gas that people drill, and if they have a market for it,
yep,
is the, probably about the best in the world.
I would say so, yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just on that point, and without numbers in front of me, I'm trying to remember, say a facility like Agrium, if it came back online, mm-hmm, how does that position, you know, factor into your, they would be large enough to be considered an anchor?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, yes, they would. In fact, if Agrium brings, they've got two trains at the facility. Each train takes between 24 and 25 BCF per year. So if the full facility comes on, that's 50 BCF. Our utility and field gas and refinery base demand right now in South Central is 80 BCF a year. Donlin would add another 12 BCF a year. So we have those large anchor potentials out there. Thank you.
Representative Harper.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your court, your response to Representative Seaton, I heard you very much identify that, you know, certainly the gross sales price for the extracted resource in Cook Inlet is certainly higher than your Henry Hub prices. Would your conclusion also, in considering that, would it be the same conclusion when you really looked at what the net income of a company performing in Cook Inlet was, when you really take into consideration the cost structures, the fact that you develop gas in Cook Inlet, well, you want to sell it to Japan, there's a great big ocean in between you. So were you addressing the net profitability of a company coming into Cook Inlet and operating, or was it really more in the context of really the fact that, yeah, we got a high gross price? At the bottom line, at the end of the day, it's gross doesn't matter, net matters.
Absolutely. Representative Hawker, through the chair, you're correct. Costs have got to be, as you know, a consideration in any of those business decisions. And Alaska, both Cook Inlet and the North Slope, are higher cost operating environments. Our labor costs more, our services cost more. We are where we are geographically, and transportation costs certainly from an export standpoint will come into play. I think if companies look for an area where they can make a good return on the gas, their internal rates of return will drive that. I still think that with a robust market, Cook Inlet and Alaska are good places to be. But your point is very well taken, that net and that end of the day margin matter, and that's driven by cost.
And thank you. And Mr. Chair, do I say, as the guy that was the sponsor of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, it truly was the intent to make our basin competitive and attractive and attract the level of production we've seen.
Proceed.
All right, very good. Well, with that, we'll stop and turn over to Director Alper. And we've left off at the beginning of the Frontier Basin in your slides, and happy, as I said, to answer any questions that you may have as you review those slides.
Well, I'm a brief at ease. I'll call the meeting back to order. We're in the midst of a presentation. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, picking up where I left off, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And I want to apologize first off for sitting here by myself. Commissioner Hoffbeck is in transit back from New York. And the senior economists, who are my backup team for Monday's hearing, are back in the office putting the finishing touches on the presentation we'll be giving to this committee tomorrow morning with some of the life cycle modeling. Also, before I pick up, I wanted to say a word or two about the evolution of our forecasting process that our friends from DNR were talking about a little while ago. The Department of Revenue is charged with forecasting oil production primarily for the purpose of forecasting revenue. That's our job, is to produce the revenue sources book and determine how much revenue the state of Alaska can expect. Most of the source data for that is tied to our own outreach from industry. We don't make this up. We talk to people from industry, multiple companies every year. They tell us their drilling plans, their expectations, and we build that into a drilling forecast. And then we have for many years used the services of an outside consulting engineer, a petroleum engineer, who would help us convert that data into decline curves and expected volumes And then to that, in more recent years, we would layer on some risk factors and delay principles of expectations for the new oil, the under development and under evaluation. What we faced in the last year or so, frankly, is because of budget shortfalls, we re-looked at how we paid for these services, that we thought rather than going to outside consulting services that cost the state substantial amounts of money, that much of that expertise and professional knowledge in petroleum engineering existed within the state's own system in the Department of Natural Resources. So we looked to them to help us through it beginning this year. We are the client, and they are in many ways our consultant, and they are going to be taking the same data set, the information on what wells are going to be drilled, and helping us to turn it into the forecast that will be brought before this committee in the fall revenue sources book. If there are changes in behavior, whether tied to market forces or any changes in legislation, those will be reflected in the fall forecast. We begin that outreach generally in the months of August and September. I guess one additional apology I want to make. I listened to the rerun of Monday's presentation while I was getting ready for bed last Monday, and I realized I was talking very fast. These are very complex and very technical issues. I really do need to slow down and make sure. I felt a little under pressure to get through it. The last Monday's committee started a little bit late, so please indulge me and let me know if I'm going too fast. I will go through the issues at your pace and at whatever and stop for any questions, and we'll do our best to get through the rest of it. We are scheduled to be before you on Thursday. I know you have other testifiers, but we also stand at the ready for any of the other hearings, including, I believe, Saturday is something of a planned.
Representative Harker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned Commissioner Hoffbeck isn't here, and I think we all know that he's been out east discussing state fiscal prospects with the state's rating agencies and securities analysts. So I'm wondering, do you have any idea what the rating agencies' responses were to consideration that, you know, we're here looking at imposing a major tax increase on our only sustaining industry in a time when that industry is facing severe economic losses? Did they give you any input on this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I have not spoken to Commissioner Hoffbeck on his experiences in New York. He'll be getting back tonight, and I'll be speaking to him tomorrow. I know that from the point of view of the rating agencies, they are as concerned as anything else with the state's budget shortfall, with our ability to prove that we can continue to balance our budget. And we present to them, as we present to you, this bill as part of a package of reducing that budget deficit. It'd
be interesting to speak with him. Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, the slide before you, number two, is from the table of contents from the presentation I began on Monday. We were more or less halfway through the fourth bullet, the details as to how the pieces work. We went through some of the historic cost information, overview of the oil and gas economy, and so our thoughts about what has worked and what hasn't, what's scheduled for sunset, what's expected to continue, what we're repealing in this bill, sort of summarizing the suite of credits that are in Alaska's portfolio. I'm now going to zoom ahead to slide, I believe it was 36 I was on when we ended, ran out of time on Monday. I've grayed out the scenario analysis. That's the detailed, the life cycle type work. That's the presentation being finalized that we should have before the committee at 8:30 tomorrow morning. We have appended to the end of this some questions, some slides that were put together by DNR to address some of the issues of gas supply in Cook Inlet, in some ways building on what they were talking about a little bit earlier in this presentation. So should we get to the end of this document, we'll see some of those gas supply issues. So I'm skipping through all of the slides that were discussed in Monday's hearing. And the last subject we were talking about is what's involved in strengthening the minimum tax by preventing certain credits from being able to be used to reduce payments below the so-called floor, the 4% minimum tax. And we discussed how the GVR eligible fields, some of the issues there, and how we propose to make the so-called new oil pay at the 4% minimum, as well as the issue of the major producers who might have an operating loss credit due to losing money in one calendar year from being able to use that operating loss credit in the next calendar year to offset their minimum production taxes and pay something like zero. And that was the last topic. You might remember these slides, 35 and 36. They were very complex, but these were more or less monthly cash flow slides to show how when you have a second year of low taxes, what could happen when you start offsetting the minimum tax with
the operating loss credit, and then yet more operating loss credits stack up into the future. So the next section, the issue that I have not yet discussed, also on the topic of strengthening the minimum tax, is one that was very difficult to explain when I was before the committee a couple of weeks ago, the idea of the per taxable barrel credits being able to be used to offset production taxes from another month. The current law, as it's written, allows those monthly earned taxes to be used anywhere in the year. Really, this is only relevant when you have a lot of volatility, specifically with certain of the months of the year impacted by the minimum tax and certain months of the year that are not impacted by the minimum tax. So in the months with the minimum tax, typically the entire $8 cannot be used. The companies will start to use that $8 per barrel credit, bump up against the minimum tax, and then lose the rest of it. If there are other months of the year, those lost credits have been able to be applied to reduce earlier months' taxes down towards that minimum tax level. And I have some graphs in this document that will show a little more clearly what it is that we're talking about. And the last bullets here, in the past, the ACES bill was a true monthly tax. The progressivity, the entirety of the tax rate was monthly. That regime was eliminated 3 years ago. What's before us now is more of a true annual tax. We are seeking something of a hybrid, where one small component of the tax would be kind of locked into the month in which it was earned, so as to prevent some upside risk to the state. When there are several months of high oil prices, our contention is the state should be able to earn all of the taxes earned in those high months and not have those high month revenues eroded by a possible credits that were earned in low month years later on in the year. So what we have before you on slide 39 is a model of the actual conditions of what happened in calendar year 2014. So if you will, the top of the yellow bar is the entirety of the production tax based on 35% of production tax value, the statutory calculation of what the tax would be given the information provided by our producing taxpayers. The top of the green line, or after subtracting the yellow, is the actual tax paid after application of the per taxable barrel credit. So you could see the size in the early months of the year when prices were higher. The gray line across the top looks like it just might be a stray line. That's actually a line tied to the axis on the right-hand side, which is the price of oil. And you could see a price of oil that was over $100, dipped under $100 for the last time in the month of August, and was down around $50 by December. So in those earlier months of the year, the per taxable barrel credit was either $5 or $6 per month. That number, as you know, Mr. Chairman, increases as the price decreases to hit a peak of 8 at below a price of oil of between $80 or $90. So that's why the yellow bar got thicker in September and October, and then into November and December. What happened is there is no more green bar. What the red bar is 4% of gross tax. The 4% of the gross is what must be paid based upon the minimum tax calculation, and the dotted lines in the November and December, those show those per taxable barrel credits that were effectively lost to the producers. They were not able to use them because there wasn't enough delta between the top of the yellow bar and the top of the red bar. And I'm going to sort of pause and see if there's any questions at that moment, because the next slide takes this a step further. Not seeing any, Mr. Chairman. Good. Moving to slide number 40, we could see what happened here is you could see the same dotted lines in November and December. What the companies were able to do is migrate those credits to effectively offset the great bulk of January's production tax above the level of the floor. And what that meant was at the time of our annual true-up in April of 2015, we refunded companies $112 million. That was the amount of lost credits that we were able to migrate to prior month's tax liability. So that's the phenomenon that actually did occur. We've created a second scenario that would show a more extreme example of what I've just presented. In a year of greater price volatility, the credit recovery, or the ability to migrate credits, could take up an even greater share and could push a large portion of the state's production tax, even in high-cost, high-priced months, down to the minimum tax level. And this occurs because, once again, the minimum tax calculation is an annual tax. So the credits that cannot be used within the year, they can be recovered within the year, could be recovered at the year's end. So the slide 43 is a more hypothetical and dramatic drop that occurs earlier in the year. So here we have a scenario where in January of year X, the price of oil is 90. By December, it's down to 50. And you recognize the structure of this chart. The yellow bar is the production tax based on the statutory 35% calculation. The green bar is that tax after the application of the sliding scale credit, which for most of these months would be $8 per barrel. And then beginning in June and getting larger in the later months, you see a growing dotted line, which is per taxable barrel credits that are lost, that are foregone because of the inability to use them because of the minimum tax. The companies are forced to pay at the red minimum tax level during those months. But on slide 43, and I'll go back a second, you could see the relative thickness of the green bars in January and February in slide 42. Those bars are completely wiped out by the migration of all of those unused credits from June through December and offset against February. And the total in this calculation, which was something of a snapshot created by our staff, leads to $233 million in lost credits, or about a third of the total production tax revenue for this theoretical year is lost at true-up. So what the bill before you is doing is, and the language in it is somewhat complicated, but what it does is it locks in the per taxable barrel credit to the month in which it was earned and doesn't allow it to migrate from month to month within the calendar year.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Alper, was there any discussion in either body or in any committee about this phenomenon? And before you answer, I mean, I would say that it's the law, and arguably it doesn't matter if there was, but I am curious nonetheless if this came up in any presentation that you're aware of.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we did actually review the committee record on this one, specifically in this committee, the House Resources Committee at the time. The gentleman that was doing the bulk of the carrying of the bill on behalf of the previous administration was Deputy Commissioner Pawlowski. When asked similar questions, where he had a line of questioning with Representative Seaton at the time, his understanding was that this was a monthly credit, a monthly calculation, that it wasn't that it was intended to be taken within the month it was earned. Now, to be fair, the committee record nor the thinking at the time did not contemplate the minimum tax, did not contemplate that there would be years in which we would be at the floor, that this phenomena, which is before you, would be relevant. And I don't believe it was addressed. In the context of a normal year in which there is no minimum tax, Mr. Pawlowski was absolutely correct. This is a monthly calculation. The credit rate itself does change from month to month, as the price of oil might change from month to month. But the ability to recapture it at true-up did not become relevant until roughly 18 months ago, again, when the price of oil dropped to a level where, for the first time in our history of having a net profits tax, we fell into the realm of minimum tax, of paying at the floor.
Thank you.
Okay. So much of what's on this slide summarizes what I've already said. The issue of this particular strengthening the minimum tax issue is only an issue in years of relatively high oil price volatility, where some but not all of the months trigger the minimum tax. And the example on those two slides showing moderate to high oil volatility reduced the state's tax payments by close to 30%. And if you were to look at an effective tax rate on net profits, it reduced that in our calculations from about 14.5% to 10.5% of as an effective tax rate. And this, again, as was said a couple of slides ago, this phenomenon causes the state to give up or forego some fraction of the upside in years where the monthly oil prices might be very high and otherwise would generate high revenues. We lose some of that revenue because of the offset from the months in which prices are low. Now, another phenomenon, in the future, as tariff rates begin to increase, you'll start seeing wellhead values decreasing, and that might mean, for example, the per taxable barrel credit itself will start to trend towards the larger numbers, the $7 and $8 range, rather than the $5 and $6 range that was envisioned in some of the committee discussion during the last major fiscal change.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Mr. Upper, when you talk about an increase in tariff rates, is that because we're getting to more unconventional oil, or what are you, why are you anticipating a tariff rate increase?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the most prominent factor in increasing tariff rates or declining production. When the cost of operating the transportation system is relatively fixed and as fewer barrels go through it, each one has to pay a higher share of the freight.
Okay. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, on this particular provision, this is the part that has the retroactivity component. So in Section 17, the other pieces of it, Part A and Part B, deal with the credits in a little different way. This is the Part C, but everything in this section is intended to be retroactive to January 1st. And so I guess that's because you're thinking at true up at the end of the 2016 calendar year. You want to avoid this problem for 2016 at all. I guess is what I'm suspecting is the reason you'd want to have a retroactive effective date on that. But say this bill passed or some version of this bill passed and, you know, we did just like on the fiscal year, for example, started that. I mean, how difficult would that be at the true up to have the year divided like that? And just trying to understand, you know, how that impacts the planning on the part of the companies to have it be retroactive in nature.
So, through the chair, Representative Tarr, two halves to the answer. The intent of the retroactivity is to have this phenomenon take effect, be eliminated for the current calendar year, mm-hmm. so that to the extent that there are and if the bill obviously doesn't pass until the end of a legislative session, there would have to be some sort of makeup payment or some sort of a way to account for that come the first monthly payment after the passage of the bill. But the concept of a split year for many of these provisions that affect the calendar year tax are very problematic. They have caused complex situations inside the audit staff in the past. The ACES bill, for example, took effect on July 1st, 2007. But it's a calendar year tax. It led to a situation where, in many ways, they had to split 2007 into two separate tax returns and do a full analysis of the first 6 months, separate and distinct from a full analysis of the second 6 months. So to the extent features that impact the underlying tax calculation for the tax-paying producers changes in the middle of a year, it will lead to some inevitable complexities in the administering of that tax.
And a follow-up question, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And looking at the fiscal notes, could you remind me, please, what dollar amount is attributed to this component?
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, the one fiscal note that shows the fund capitalization element also shows the negative numbers in spending, and all of the provisions of the bill that reduce credit payments or eliminate certain credits are encompassed in that negative number. All of the minimum tax changing provisions are in the other fiscal note that shows the positive revenue numbers. So what you see in the early couple of years is a $100 million revenue estimate declining to a $50 million revenue estimate in the out years. The $50 million in every year is the rough estimate for the annual additional revenue from an increase in the minimum tax from 4% to 5%. Now, previous slides and this slide deck before you that we went through Monday show that there is some variability in that, and depending on the price of oil, that could be a number between roughly $30 and $70 million. And with the next generation of this fiscal note, we will incorporate some of that more nuanced modeling to that element of the calculation. The second $50 million that's in the early years is the impact specifically of not being able to use operating loss credits to offset minimum tax payments from the major producers. Okay. That based on our forecast, this is a phenomenon that's only in place for the current and next year. So it's about a two-year problem. Then it will go away of its own accord if our forecasted prices hold, because at that point, we don't expect any of our producers to be losing money, therefore won't be earning an operating loss credit. The specific provision in 17C that I've been discussing thus far today is not forecasted to have any value simply because our price forecasts do not consider volatility, that we have a fixed number for the year, and this is a phenomenon that's only relevant in a year where there's a lot of up and down, and we're looking at annual average numbers and therefore can't project the value of up and down.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. This whole dialogue, and I say I've just, basically here to now in this presentation the last two sessions, you've largely been using one circumstance, and that's the year 2014, to really talk about and illustrate the interplay of truly major components of the overall tax construct. And this tax construct has evolved since the end of ELF way back when. You cite your research of hearings in the last legislative session, but in all of this, have you got any evidence, do you have any support and any evidence that would show that the legislature intended our major tax constructs to be anything other than an annualized tax cycle? You clearly are looking to have this parsed into a more granular tax cycle of literally an isolated monthly cycle. But do you have any evidence that it was not the legislature's clear intent to have these be annual cycles for the, frankly, again, to do just exactly what we're talking about here, annualize other activity that can be volatile on both the taxpayer and thus as the tax administrator?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, the specific provision addressed in Section 17C of House Bill 247 relates to the application of the per taxable barrel credit. So that is a new credit that did not take effect until January of 2014 with the passage of Senate Bill 21. In the description of that credit in the bill itself, it described it as a monthly credit and a monthly calculation that very explicitly varies from month to month depending on the average price of oil in that calendar month. If it's below $90 gross value, it's $8, between $90 and $107, et cetera. So the value of the credit was quite explicitly monthly. It, as for the ability to use it from month to month, it was neither addressed nor not addressed. It was, to the extent it was discussed, the deputy commissioner described it as a monthly calculation. That one specific provision of the new law was said to be a monthly calculation. All other provisions of the calculation are absolutely an annual calculation. And by the elimination of progressivity, which was the most extreme monthly calculation in the prior tax regime, in many, many ways, Alaska's oil and gas tax system was converted from a monthly to an annual-based system. But the remnant of a monthly system that was retained with the passage of Senate Bill 21 was this specific calculation of the per-taxable barrel credit.
Respectfully, I disagree completely with your characterization that the changes made moved us from a monthly to an annual calculation as the progressivity was eliminated, but we're never going to agree on it, and I'd ask you to continue. Thank you.
I'm Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at slide 43, again, I'm trying to figure out if this work would work. This is a hypothetical, I take it. Is this work only in going back and calculating what the tax would have been in by applying it to past months, or does it move the other way as well and have a carry forward that would diminish forward months as well?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes. We built this model with a declining tax, with declining oil price, much as the earlier set of 2014 actuals was a declining price. But the phenomenon works the same exact way in reverse. If there are unused credits in January, but there is adequate credit value in November and December because the price of oil is recovered, they could just as well be carried forward. The one essential limitation is this is a calendar year tax, and any such adjustment or migration must occur within a calendar year.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
And so, we've got these green bars in here. The current situation we're in, if we're making this retroactive to January 1 or if that's a proposal, are there any green bars to take advantage of or to apply it to at this point in time, or would that only be would we have to go back and capture any be any payments or anything, because going forward there wouldn't be anything to apply, would there?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, to the best of our knowledge, and we won't know for sure until we see the annual tax true-ups at the end of March, every single month of calendar year 2015 was a minimum tax month. Therefore, whatever per taxable barrel credits were foregone are foregone and are not recoverable. It's in calendar year 2016. Obviously, we're only 2 months in. We're all hoping for substantial price recovery, in which case this will come into play at the end of the year in April of 2017 when those taxes are trued up.
But, Mr. Chairman, but there wouldn't be any going back and having a tax calculation that was paid previously in January or February or March because they were all at minimum tax. So it wouldn't be like you would have them be coming in and make an adjustment. Is that correct?
Correct. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, if you look at the graph before you, October and November, that's about what pretty much every month in 2015 looked like. There's a minimum tax payment. There's a certain amount of per taxable barrel credit that was used that varied. It got smaller and smaller as the prices went down later in the year. And then there was a certain amount of those per taxable barrel credits that was foregone. So there would literally be no green bar, to use the metaphor of this slide, against which to apply anything in all of calendar year 2015.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Aaron.
Mr. Alper, you've used the word phenomenon quite a few times today. And so I'd like to understand why you keep using that word. It's a situation that's known to exist, but is it being used because you question the fact or the situation?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I apologize if the word seems inappropriate. It was an unexpected occurrence based upon our intuitive understanding how the tax was supposed to work, and then when we saw how it was working in practice, it was different. I don't know what the appropriate word to describe that is. It's by no means magical. Everything that we've seen is a literal interpretation of the statutes as they're written.
No, I get that. I'm just trying to understand because normally it means that that it's a fact or a situation that is happening or is occurring, but you're also at the same time you're questioning it. And I just want to make sure I understand why you use the word so much.
Well, we have.
Thank you.
We're going beyond our time, and so we're going to continue tomorrow at 8:30 a.m. And so with the continuation of the presentation, the HB 247, and so we will adjourn here momentarily. But before that, I'd like to thank Director Corey Feige from the Natural Resources, Commissioner Harbeck, Ken Alver, and Sherry Neenhouse from the Department of Revenue for being available today. Our next committee meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30 a.m. and we'll continue with the Department of Revenue's House Bill 247 presentation. We will gavel out at